Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to the Legendary Cycling Podcast for our Santos Tour Down Under mega recap of both the men and women's editions. The 10 days or so of racing has, well, it's about a week actually of racing has wrapped up now down in Adelaide with, I think, some pretty, pretty nice things to talk about. It's good to see Willunga was back. We had some interesting sprints. We had a lot of young riders performing in both races. But what have you been up to, Benji? I'm cooked. It's so hot here. It's like the humidity here and dew point is unbelievable. It's actually unbelievable how hot it is the last 2 days. I got heat. I did my first intensity on the bike yesterday for a long time, with some threshold intervals, and I started too late. I started at 5:30. I should have started at 4:45 in the morning.
And you've got a heat stroke?
I'm cooked, yeah.
I'm completely sleep deprived because I spent the last 6 days at Santos Tour Down Under at night, basically, because I'm in the UK doing partially the Twitter account for the Santos Tour Down Under. So it's important that I do disclose that. And contractually, I need to tell you that my views on this podcast are my own and not that of the Santos Tour Down Under, which I think is pretty obvious, but I have to say it anyway. But man, I'm so sleep deprived. Like 4 hours a night I was sleeping, but then it's also like my circadian rhythm or whatever you call that is so switched off to the point that I had to sleep 2 hours in the afternoon sometimes to try and catch up to sleep. And I tried doing a Zwift race today, mate. What, sorry?
So you feel fine now because normally you've got like another 5-6 hours to go.
Normally I'd feel fine, but this stupid guy decided to do a 2.5 hour Zwift race today after 6 days of sleep deprivation. And I've never felt so empty on my bike ever. I've never been so deep.
Damn. Well, maybe sleep. Yeah, catch up on some sleep would be my recommendation. Although I'm making your podcast super late at night. Anyway, we'll start with the men's race. We had 4 sprints in the 6 stages, 1 sort of mixed sprint, I would say, of those, as well as the last 2 stages being the big GC stages, Willunga Hill and Mount Lofty. Mount Lofty was where Mount Lofty was where Simon Yates won last year. Jayco came into the race with big ambitions. They brought a very strong team. Simon Yates, Lucas Blapp, Caleb Ewan. 3 of their 5, I would say, big riders in Groenewegen and Matthews are in Valencia at the moment, as well as strong. So Chris Harper was the best climbing domestique any team had in this race, I would say. And so they had big ambitions. I will say, I think Blapp is getting killed a little bit because he said before the race, you know, we want to win every stage. I think what he meant was, we have brought a team where it's a realistic goal that we try to win every stage, and that we have a sprinter, we have me and Yates for the 2 GCs. I think that's what he meant. He didn't say, you know, not five, not 6, not 7 championships. I give him the benefit of the doubt for that.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. He's not that kind of guy that would be like, oh, we're definitely going to win because we're riding against peasants. That's not really Luke Blapp. But yeah, you said it. Like, 3 sprint stages, 1 versatile one. That was the start of the Santos Tour Down Under, and I kind of like it. And can I say, Santos Tour Down Under without Willunga Hill? Sorry, but I don't care. So Willunga Hill's back. I care about this race again because this is probably the race I've played the most in my life on Pro Cycling Manager. This is the first fucking race you have in that race, in that game. But anyway, let's start with stage 1. Short recap. Basically, TLDR summary, Welsford ends up winning the sprint after what I would consider a perfect lead out by Van Poppel, by Mullen, that entire squad. Who is the 4th man at Bora? Because was that Gumper or was that Maciejczuk?
Don't know. I think Matsuyuk was like a good signing for them.
I think Matsuyuk was doing like the pacing during the stage.
Okay.
And I would guess that Gumper is then the fourth man, because it's also important
they really
for
have a fourth
Gumper
man,
to then position. What's sorry?
Like they kind of, the three of them kind of hang out until they want to do their final lead out a lot of the time.
True.
At
true.
The back. But they and made everyone look like peasants this race. Like this lead out was completely overpowered. It was a lead out that basically it looked good. Well, it looked good a lot of last year, and then they split Mullen and Van Poppel apart for the Tour de France, and then Van Poppel on his own actually wasn't good in the Tour. No, they couldn't compete with Alpecin. Or even Bahrain and Jumbo some stages. But yeah, this lead out was unbelievable. It was an omen of things to come on stage one.
Being a lead out like Mirko and Van Poppel doesn't mean that you can do it yourself, because you need a Van Poppel for yourself then. You need that rider for yourself to do the lead out for you to then be able to still sprint at the end. And otherwise, they're kind of doing the work of both the lead out and the sprinter. So yeah, I think sometimes people overrate how easy it is from a perspective of, oh, why aren't they not sprinting for Mirko back in the day when Cavendish was a sprinter? Remember when Mirko got second and they were like, oh, Mirko should start going for himself. It's not that easy. But we said it, Welsford won. Second stage was the versatile sprint stage. We had this, I think it was Fox Creek, a hill with about, in the last 10 kilometers somewhere, Luke Plapp attacks on it. Very brutal attack. Straight up drops everybody except Narváez. Yep. Can I just say Narváez, really strong race by him.
And he won the crit.
Yeah, he did win the crit ahead of
Del Toro and a couple other sort of climbers, yeah.
We'll get to him in a second, but they don't cooperate, and that means that the group behind ends up coming back, which leads to what one would think is a versatile sprint at the end, but there was no real organization, and someone benefits from that with 1K to go. Some people try to attack earlier, like Quinn Simmons and so forth, but Del Toro attacks with 1K to go, straight up wins. Like, man creates a gap that didn't exist, suddenly is like 20, 25 meters, and he keeps it to the line.
What I'm learning about like power data and especially in the last year or so is that his attack was so impressive and so explosive that it almost made me think he's going to struggle on Willunga.
Yeah.
Because I was like not win on Willunga, because I was like, you to hold off the peloton being chased by Nick Schultz. Israel brought a good team to this race, by the way, for these sort of stages. Nick Schultz, Simon Clark, Bovin, Stephen Williams, Corbin Strong. That is a good team for this, which we'll see later. That's a good team for these sort of stages. And they were going for Strong. Maybe Williams took too long to get back on the front, but for Del Toro as a sub 70 kilo guy to hold off the peloton with a 1 minute attack, his power was per kilo explosivity must have been unbelievably high, and he wins almost comfortably. I was like, holy shit, like this guy got to go to Liège or the classics, I don't know, get him in.
And it's important to say he didn't just do that attack at the end of the stage. During that stage he fought for the first intermediate sprint. He tried out sprinting Caleb Ewan at the second intermediate sprint, but he put so much power on his pedals, that's my theory, he put so much power on his pedals that I think his chain did something, and then he had to like stop mid-sprint. And then I swear there was a moment in the descent after the attack of Luke Plapp where he was trying to pace Fisher Black back to the front of the race.
He's pulling Fisher Black, yeah.
Mate, he just had an engine that didn't run out that stage.
Yeah. So obviously he then goes into the leader's jersey with the bonus seconds, but I think he finishes on the same time. Corbin Strong basically just beats his teammate who was leading him out, Stephen Williams, on the bike throw. And if the race had played out any differently in the end, you could have gone 50-50 hindsight and said, well, actually, Stephen Williams needed those extra two bonies. But it didn't matter, I guess, in the end. But that was I think Israel, we see this a lot. That's why everyone loves these stages. That's why all the race organizers put in these sort of stages, because you have a really interesting race dynamic almost guaranteed in the last 10-15 kilometers. Stage three, Welsford wins with another good lead out, basically just ruining everybody. I think Viviani got into his wheel, but just wasn't quick enough. Binny, the issues with Binny's positioning or lack of lead out seem to be there as well. I'm sure Binny does have the 10-second power to be, you know, at least coming second in all these sprints, but he was struggling to sort of hold position. And yep. Ewan was not competitive. Like, he was getting into good position on a couple of them, and then he just was getting cooked by everybody.
It switched after stage three, because on stage one, Ewan got a podium, if I recall correctly. On stage three, he sprinted to fifth, so in a relatively competitive position. And then on stage four, you've got the fact that Luke Blapp crashes out with about 10 kilometers to go, like straight up crashes out of the race. His back looked awful. Like, that man probably didn't sleep for like the last few days. But Blapp was important in keeping the lead out of Jayco at the front of the peloton in stage one and three. And in stage four, they straight up couldn't get to the front. They tried twice and they got squeezed the entire way through. So Ewan was in like 35th, 50th positions or something going into the sprint, and then you can't compete. And at the front, you have Welsford once again, but this time losing the wheel of Van Poppel. I reckon that he might have been able to follow it, but he probably didn't want to risk his life or send us to the understage after having already won two. But he still wins the stage, so it doesn't matter. Eh? Like, it's once again a strong performance. Three, a hat trick, an unofficial hat trick, because Blapp won a... No, because Del Toro won a stage in between. But yeah, what's your view going into the last two stages then? Because Del Toro's still in lead?
Yeah. Well, I thought Del Toro, it's not going to be a formality to drop him on Willunga, but Willunga is actually like a 7 to 10 minutes effort, actually, when you include they always do the little run in before, which is like 4%. They still do that over 400 watts. So it's actually like a 10 or 8 to 10 minute effort. So my question was, if no team makes it super hard, I think Del Toro could just beat because it levels out in the last 200. You wouldn't want to sprint against him.
Yeah.
he's so quick. And also, he's got the last stage as well, so you're not going to knock him out of GC. But it was really on Jayco. They got Chris Harper. They got to make something happen. He's, I don't know how far behind on GC at that point. Over 10 seconds, I think, with Del Toro taking bonies. And they had to make something happen. Tail window, which was good, but they're missing Plap. So normally they'd use Plap, I think, to make the... They do two reps of Willunga. I think they would have used Plap to make the first rep nuclear pace. And they still did over 400 watts, I think, but they would have used Plap to make the first rep nuclear. Or
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I think Harper, I think that's for what first they would have done. Harper first rep and try and use Luke Plap to attack on the second one, because they use the strategy of Yates.
Oh, if you're still in GC, opening, okay, I get it.
Yeah, they use the strategy of Yates opening the gap in front of him to let Harper go on the last Willunga Hill. And I reckon that was probably what they would have done with Plap, because Plap's form on Fox Creek shouts at me that he strong enough to compete for the victory in this race.
With a tailwind on 7%, getting a gap would have been difficult to bring him back. And maybe there's dynamics in the group behind. I think Yates lost the race there. So yeah, they get onto Willunga, last rep. Harper's smashing it. Over 500 watts. And the group is like in a line. A lot of the GC contenders are not in the first five positions. Del Toro's nowhere. Hague's nowhere. They're like P20. Narvaez is there, but he's on the limit. He's like on the limit there. And it's early. I think Yates lost the race there when he let Harper's wheel go. I think he didn't want to go too early, but Port always went really early. I think the reality is his 2 minutes and 1 minute is not as explosive as Narvaez, Williams, Del Toro. And yeah, he let the wheel go. I think if he goes there, I don't think Narvaez holds his wheel. And then it's the question of who, the guys who are way deeper, who's going to pull them back? Because no team really had a prime mountain domestique there, except in theory, Bart Lemon for Milan Vada was actually, that was his role.
And Fisher Black and Del Toro won't work with each other, UAE style.
Yeah. So I think that was his only option. Maybe it's 2020 hindsight. But yeah, he lets Harper's wheel go. I think the Plus pulls for a bit, brings Narvaez close. Narvaez then has to close the last bit himself, or Harper stopped because then he wasn't fully gassed. Then there's kind of, I'm not sure. Yates eventually does give it a big nudge, but it was later in the climb and he's closed. Alaphilippe looked pretty good.
He was back for a bit.
He looked pretty good.
Mate, on this climb, Alaphilippe was in the running to win the stage, Yeah, until he decided to try and win the KOM at the top instead of the finish line 200 meters further.
I imagine you're at max heart rate. You see the climb crests, and there's a line on the ground where the climb crests. It is like, I know the Strava KOM is great and all, but like, that is confusing. So I'm not going to slate him for that, but yeah, he sprints basically full gas 200 meters before the finish.
I mean,
they all do. That would be good. But they all do a recon. They all recon with Langer like a million times, and they also they literally do a rep before. They do a rep 20 minutes, half an hour before. So
no excuse.
That was classic Alaphilippe stuff, and Anyway, man, we haven't mentioned yet the young Scott. He's just there. Oh, sorry, Bart Lemon had gone to the front to drive it behind Yates. And then he drops Varda. I'm like, well, that hierarchy's the wrong way around. And he basically then looks back and then starts riding for his own result. And Oscar Onley's in the wheels, following the advice, making all the right decisions, following Yates, not getting closed off. Like, Lemon cost himself 3 seconds because he let Yates close him off, and Onley's just showing really good race IQ, gets around before the left-hander, bang, hits Stevie Williams and Narváez with a big kick. Like, you can see he put into a bigger gear and, like, gapped them, and those guys are fast. Those are their fast guys, and really, really impressive win from him. His first World Tour win, probably DSM's best win.
Wait, man.
In a while?
You can't let this opportunity slide. His only World Tour win.
Nice. Yeah, it was a good win. And I was like, he then doesn't go into the leader's jersey, though. Stephen Williams, who finishes second, he goes into the leader's jersey on countback, which is, basically it's the aggregate stage positions.
Correct. So number one is the tiebreaker. If you're close on the same, if you're on the same time, 0 seconds. The tiebreaker, the first one, is the milliseconds of an individual time trial. Number two is the sum of your stage positions, like you say. And number three then is the current stage, I think, position.
Okay. Beyond me. But that was a really nice performance from Onley. They did the same time as Richie Porte, give or take a second, 6:34, 6:35 on the climb proper, but they had a big, big tailwind. So Porte doing it, half the time solo, not with the same monster tailwind, obviously going to be different watts. I think highlights from the climb, or not highlights, actually, just nice things to note, I guess, was Valentin Paris-Pantre. In seventh was a decent result. I'd like to see the PP brothers kick on this year. I think they actually are quite good. They're good, man. They're good. Del Toro, eighth. Yeah, just gapped at the end of that climb. Bart Lemon in fifth was a big, big surprise.
Yeah.
Varda wasn't good, though. He won Guangxi, which is like a low intensity race with a sort of finish like this. A similar finish. He won that last year, and he wouldn't be expecting to finish in the 24th. Other people who maybe expected to be better would be, Storer,
Ryan, Ulisi, I guess.
Yeah, even Simon Yates, frankly. It was a nice climb, some different names in the top, but that put us into a very interesting GC position for the final stage. Mount Lofty, which was quite aggressive last year, won by Simon Yates, who won the stage ahead of Jay Vine, who won GC. They finished 1-2. But Williams basically had to, he had to not lose a single second to Onley. This is a strat, but not just Onley, because he also had Narváez on 5 seconds and Del Toro on 5 seconds. So if they just beat him, either of those two, they take a 6 second delta and they win GC. If Alaphilippe on 13 seconds or Simon Yates win the stage and take with 3 or 4 seconds on the road, which is not much, then they win GC. So it was all to play for on the final stage, which was like it's a lumpy circuit around Mount Lofty.
I'm not sure we're watching at that point, but what did you think about Simon Yates' attack? 120 kilometers to go?
I didn't watch that. What was that?
he just straight up, there was a breakaway formation phase, relatively a rough one. Like the entire week, all the breaks just flew out. But this one was like 20 kilometers of fighting. And one of them included Simon Yates trying to attack away, which I found intriguing. Like it's enjoyable, but it also shows that they just have two little riders now to be able to pull off the hardness of a race that they want to pull off. Because I think this Mount Lofty stage is one Mount Lofty less than last year.
Okay. And yeah, it's only two or three reps. I don't know why they were using Harper that way in the break formation. I would have been trying to make Israel burn numbers personally. But yeah, it was actually not that open a race, frankly. Like there was a breakaway with like the first time we've seen Morgado at the front of a race, the UAE talent, which was interesting. Also, Hill Helders on Quickstep was very, very strong. I was impressed by him also on this lumpy course. Ballastet sat on the back of the break right the whole time and then like was following like attacks at the end. So that was a bit strange.
Took an intermediate sprint as well.
Yeah. I'm not sure he was popular in that breakaway.
Who wasn't in this break, but I do want to shine a light on him and his team was Luke Burns from the Aussie national team.
Yeah.
So they really played it really well the entire week when it comes to KOM points, to the point that he was relatively secure after three stages because it was likely that GC riders would take at least one rep of Mount Lofty, etc. So all that kept in mind, they played it really well. They tried to steal away points from other riders by having multiple riders fight for KOM points. It was really interesting and credits to that team. But anyway, we get to Mount Lofty and to be honest, it wasn't a crazy Mount Lofty. It was pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, basically, break gets caught, it kicks off, Del Toro big attack, it comes back, Williams is there, Narváez is there. Williams was kind of eating a lot of wind off the wheel initially, and then Pithy counterattacks because he's not a GC threat on like a rolling bit. GC guys look at him, they're like, he's FDJ, not a GC threat. Eventually, Del Toro goes again. And brings Pithy back, keeps the attack going. But then he looks back and sees Narváez and Williams. And I feel like Del Toro needed to back his sprint at a certain point. And mathematically, he can still win GC by winning the stage. He doesn't need a gap, right? If my math serves me correct, he just needs to win the stage, which is a big ask. And he basically looks to pull off 250 meters to go. It's a dipper at 200 meters to go and then dips up, kicks up again. And if he just pulled off into Williams' wheel, I think he has much, much bigger chance here. Instead, Williams hits him right into the dipper, gets a big gap on Narváez and Del Toro up to speed. And he's also, I think, heavier than those guys. And then, yeah, Williams just unbelievable timing, played it completely cool.
Yep.
Really, really savvy finish, knew the finish perfectly or played it perfectly. And he's got a damn good sprint, especially at a high speed compared to these guys too. We saw that we have seen this in previous races, but he wins the stage, wins GC at the Santos Tour down under. And I think that's, we tried to check. It appears to be Israel Premier Tech's first ever World Tour GC win. Yes. Del Toro and Narváez finished on the same time. Lemon actually comes back, finishes fourth, and then Pithy the surprise in fifth on 3 seconds. Alaphilippe led the rest of the GC hopefuls, and Williams wins GC 9 seconds ahead of Narváez, 11 seconds ahead of Del Toro, and only missed that move and moves to fourth on 20 seconds.
Good race. I actually really enjoyed it. And like Stephen Williams is the kind of a, I'd say Stephen Williams is an interesting character because I feel like he's the British Ben Hermans. Is that a weird thing to say? As in, he shows up inconsistently throughout the year. Yes, we saw him in a few breakaways last year in the Giro, but outside of that, he won Arctic Race in Norway last year. The year before that, 2022, he won a Tour de Swiss stage, which was a really competitive Tour de Swiss stage as well. And then now he wins the Santos Tour Under, and I'm like, this Stephen Williams, when he's on, he can compete in a lot of races, but he's just not on very consistently throughout the year. So what is a Stephen Williams?
Good, but not the best 5-minute climbing. and a really good flat sprint. So he basically needs that Tour de Suisse stage where it's that climb and it leveled off. And it's actually a very similar stage to Loft in that right at the end, it dips down a little bit. So like Arctic race again, like
Bologna.
He was, some Bologna stage, like the stage three of Norway, I think was a similar class, 2.1 Ks, 10.5%, but the competition wasn't as good. So I don't think he's going to come out and just sort of suddenly be top three in Liège.
Yeah.
But definitely, I think the Ben Hermans comparison is pretty good. Maybe Williams, I think Williams has a better sprint, but a big result for Israel with a stage win and the GC win, even though Strong, I think, got sick and just missed out on stage two, where he won the kick behind Del Toro. So nice win for
them.
He
was already sick when the race started, basically.
Okay.
So he was ill the first few days. So to be honest, being ill and being so close in GC, I wonder what would have happened if he wasn't ill.
But this is big points for Israel to kick off the season. It's, I mean, how many points? It's a lot of points. 500 points for GC. So Stephen Williams already on 640 points before the end of January. They will
crazy.
Take that. They will take that. Whereas
that's MSR, no?
Yeah.
600 is MSR? MSR's
maybe, maybe they boosted it to 1,000 doing a monument.
Oh, might have. I don't know.
And yeah, Corbin probably took a few points as well. So they'll be happy with that, Israel. And yeah, I think Stephen Williams, if you keep sending him to the right races, he will, I think he'll win more this season. Not a hot take. It's just, I think he'll win more. I think we've already discussed Welsford and Bora. Like it was really good to lead out. I need to see it against in UAE Tour. I still expect it to be good in UAE Tour, but that's just the next logical stepping stone to see this lead out. But it looks good so far. And Jaco Alula, though, Benji, they sort of the opposite end for Israel with the points and with their home race. They had a bit of a shocker in the end with Plap crashing and Ewan's performance and Yates. So
didn't work out. Yeah. And it's like, looking at the whole situation, I do think their race might have ended differently if Plap was able to ride the last weekend. He would have probably competed for the GC, but it's also a risk you take when you use your potential GC rider, which Plap was certainly looking at Fox Creek. If you use that rider to be your fourth-ish man in the lead out to position your sprint train, he literally crashed doing that job, being at the front of the peloton with 10 kilometers to go, trying to position that lead out. Then you're taking a risk. That's why Roglic doesn't do that, or usually doesn't do that. That's why Vingegaard doesn't do that for Olaf Koy, just thinking of names at the moment. Like, that's an important factor, and that's the risk you take when you allow your GC co-leader to make such work done. He's obviously quite versatile in that work, so he can do that. But it came at a cost this time, and it doesn't only cost him in the climbs, because as a GC rider, he would have probably competed. But also in the sprints, like I said, it takes away their rider that can position their sprint train in the sprint stages. So I think it impacted them on their entire race, and not just the climbing.
Yeah, and he had to relay with Narváez, I think.
Yeah.
I think you have to relay to establish the gap, and then you can finesse him in the last 2Ks and say, I have Ewan behind and Yates behind, and then try and counterattack him there. But I think you have to establish that gap. If you're right, if he is a GC leader, then I don't see why. And if you're like, oh, well, I'm worried about Narváez.
Narváez cleans him, though, even if you sit in his wheel. But I agree that if you're good enough,
okay, so
if you're
you lose 6 seconds.
You shouldn't be scared.
You shouldn't be scared
from Narváez for Wullinger Hill.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, okay, take it back in Wullinger. And if you're that worried about Narváez, then you're not going to win. So,
because probably if you're not dropping Narváez by 6 seconds, someone else could drop you.
Well, then you can have Yates attack Narváez, and everyone looks at Narváez in the Oka jersey to chase on Wulanga. So it just changes the race, and I think he should have relayed there. But yeah, they've been going well, Jayco, in Valencia the last two evenings, or my evenings.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Surprising performances from the men's race, Del Toro being this good, especially in terms of like explosivity in basically sprint stages I didn't see coming, because I frankly, if he could do this last year in U23s, he would have been literally just riding away on any hill and winning by like 2 minutes in like any race. So, which he didn't do last year. So, yeah, that was really, really surprising to me because I thought he was a pure climber. so that, yeah, like really, really good sprint. So I'd like to see him in the classics. He, just on that, he was the youngest winner, I think, of L'Avenir and since Oosterbrugge, which was the year before, so that's he's a very young winner.
Man, he was the youngest winner in the last three years.
In the last 12 months, he was the youngest winner of L'Avenir in the last 12 months. Well, there you go, race of the future, baby.
Yeah, the stats are real. This man's dropping facts, but it's true, and it's like I think I first heard of Isaac Del Toro in the CBU tour from Oyon, who works with Tour de Titima. What's his tagline?
Le Pedal Douce, LPD.
Yes. He is the one that spoke to me about him the first time, but people apparently were talking about him for a while because Josep Bain had like a tweet up a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, about him being at AR Monix in a cyclocross race. And I'm like, oh, I only heard of this guy halfway through 2023 and I felt like I was early.
Well, yeah, because his results weren't good before, like in 2022 they weren't good, all that good, and then in 23, yeah, he sort of first like started being good in the Italian national races, and then 10th in Jasinski, and then yeah, Sibiu good on Badialac, or like okay, and then Valdos to third, and then cleaned L'Avenir, so like big improvement last year. And he was in a San Marinese. So basically, if people don't know, the Mexican Federation is banned by the IOC.
Yeah.
Can't remember why. Luke will check.
Probably doping related.
Could be corruption.
Probably banned, both. So
they're just no saying something nefarious.
Yes.
And so basically, that's really difficult for Mexican riders, evidently. Yep. There's also not a great pathway. So four Mexican riders set up a team based in San Marino, AR Monex. They race out of there, but it's mainly Mexican riders. And yeah, he's got his own coach, Cruz, I think. And yeah, it's a big, like that's difficult, a much more difficult pathway than someone who's getting full support, like maybe the Western Europeans.
And then I feel like the Avenir organizers are making it even harder for riders from those countries to actually go through, because they put in a damn team time trial when you know it's a national team-based race. So yeah. I'm not attacking Mexican riders here, but there's more of a pool of talent being scouted in for the national team of France, Italy, whatever at the moment than there's for Mexico. So equipment as well, just everything combined gives them such a disadvantage in that race, that the fact that Del Toro still won that race after losing loads of time on that team time trial.
Yeah.
The way he won that race was absolutely crazy. Like he had a stage where he had a full comeback story, and then Codla Los, also a pretty big victory. But like,
yeah,
this man's the real thing. And also this week, like his sprint is on point.
Yeah, that's what was...
He's got a pony sprint.
But that's what surprised, like, on stage four, the he won the kick behind, but I was uphill. Yeah, I just didn't see the sprint last year, but yeah, with the TTT, like, I'm pretty sure the Scandinavians, they turn 14, they get like a gift voucher, the local wind tunnel, and like I said, you know, like it's not fair having a TTT in Tour de l'Avenir. I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, yeah, but all on that scouting point, like, no one beats Matchin. You're not going to beat Matchin for a Hispanophone. Like, he probably would have been talking to Del Toro 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, or he's talking to especially Hispanophones. So, like, him going to UAE, not surprising. AR Monix was on Colnago's, like, see the writing on the wall. But, he, yeah, just watch out for him this year. This probably won't be the last we see of him this year, I would say. But already impressing.
What's his pathway? As in, he's a young rider, obviously. He's like now breaking through even more than he already was, because like we know who won Avenir, but mainstream cycling fans don't necessarily watch L'Avenir or follow L'Avenir. And Santos Fernander is still maybe a bit more to the forefront than Avenir, but I also would think that it's still a bit. Yeah, not everyone watches Santos Fernander or watches races outside of the Tour de France. So what's going to be his pathways, upcoming participations in Tour of Oman, which actually I'm quite looking forward to. But outside of that, you said it, the dude can compete for LBL. I wonder what he would do in Italian classics at the end of the year as well.
I think he's going to be pretty unstoppable in like Tre Valley Varesino type races.
Yeah.
In that UAE team's already stacked. So I think basically you just pull Ulisi out and put him in. is what they're going to do. And that's going to be pretty effective next to Sivakov and Ishii, let alone Bugatti. And Adam Yates. Our Italian Classics team is ridiculous. And Morgado, I don't really know what type of rider he is yet. I think he's sort of an all-round one-day rider, but whether he can ride the classics, I don't know. Bart Lemon was a big surprise. He was a captain in the Dutch Air Force, went to sort of pro cycling late. Fourth in Gran Camino TT behind Vingegaard last year on the now defunct Human Powered Health men's team. And he, very, very good data, as tests well. So I wasn't
Bart
actually
Lemon?
Too surprised to see him there.
Is Bart Lemon Dutch Roglic?
No.
I'm just looking at the situation that they both kind of broke through on Slovenia. Slovenia.
Okay, I see what you mean. No, he's much I think he's much taller.
Yeah.
Dutch people don't come under 180 centimeters. Except Milan Vlahovic.
Well, he's exactly 180, so unofficially.
Yeah, maybe.
According to the internet.
Luke's just correcting on the Mexican Federation. I feel like it might be UCI and Mexican. It might be at the UCI level. But yeah, so it's not the IOC. I'll just correct that. It was the UCI suspended the Mexican Federation for governance issues, which was confirmed in the 2022 UCI Congress. So, but still functionally the same, the Federation, which makes it much more difficult for young riders from Mexico. But yeah, Lemon, good performance. Perhaps cost himself riding on the front for Varda, chasing after Yates on Willunga. Don't know what to see from him next. He'll be in the Ardennes, I think. So we'll see what he can do there. Lawrence Pithy, very, very good in this race as well for FDJ. The climb much better than I expected. And Lars Bulver was also climbing better than I expected and sprinting better than I thought at Albertson, who didn't send Groves to this race, probably wisely in the end, because I don't see him beating Welsford in these super easy stages. So I think, what Albertson chose to do, keeping Groves in Europe, probably the right thing to do. But that was the men's TDU. Pretty interesting race overall. I would like to see a Rampas finish 1 year.
Yeah.
Which does exist.
Really?
There's Montague Road, I think, next to Norton Summit. So there's like a million different roads up to Lofty. There's Montacute, Norton Summit, Freeway, Green Hill, and there's then I think Montague Oh, there's another one just but next to Norton Summit. There's Old Norton Summit. There's so many roads up there.
How many streets or places in Australia are called Mount Pleasant? There's another Mount Pleasant next to Mount Lofty.
Really?
It's not the same as in Wollongong, right? Because Wollongong's on the other side, right?
Wollongong, that's like Russia to Belgium. It's a long way away. That's Woodlands Way I'm thinking of. Woodlands Way. I think they might have done it before. There's some steep climbs up there. So I would like to see a ramp pass, really steep finish. Maybe that wouldn't be... I mean, probably good for Simon Yates, actually.
Yeah.
It was a much steeper climb as well. Narvaez, look out for Narvaez in the classics would be my tip. He looks like he is cooking, so I can't wait to see him there. But yep, any last thoughts on that before we do the women's race, Benji?
I want to talk about Lauren Spiffy for a second. The guy was really good. Three top fives in stages, was also on Mount Lofty, relatively close, did a bit of a tactical thing there where he decided to attack instead of staying in their wheel in the last kilometer, which... sprinting against them would have probably been better, but he might not have been able to follow Stephen Williams' attack in the first place. But that being said, Piffy, good race. Lars Boven, a good race. The way he climbed, plus the way he sprinted, really, really good. He was also in that, what was that ChatGPT race? Super 8 Classic last year, where Van der Poel went off with a group, and I think Boven was in group. But anyway, those are my other surprising performances, I reckon, but I think we... solidly wrapped up the men's Sand of Student Under now. So let's talk about the women's one as well for a bit. We've got three stages in the women's Sand of Student Under. First of all, we have a sprint stage. Secondly, a puncher stage. And thirdly, Woolunga Hill. So it's kind of like gradually growing to the end of the race.
Yeah.
If there were four stages, they would have invented an Alpe d'Huez there.
They couldn't, if they made it too hard early, then I think Gigante would have ended the race. So it's kind of probably a good thing the way they planned it. But yeah, three stages and yeah, something different for everybody. The first stage, the sprint was won by Ali Wollaston. Now on AG Insurance Sudal team. So they started their race pretty well. She was already good last year. Like if you look into her results, there's someone who's young, probably doesn't have the best lead out. She won Sarah Tizzett GC, winning the last stage, and won the Schwalbe Classic. So she's got a good sprint.
She won the Schwalbe Classic. I agree with the other one, but you really got that Australian crew in there just because you can?
Yeah, but it's all the riders that are about to do the TDU, and it's a sprint. Yeah, so it's like, it is relevant. Narvaez and Del Toro were good in the Schwalbe Classic this year, and it was relevant. And also good in Giro d'Onna, third and fifth in the last two stages. So she's kicked on, obviously had a good off-season, came here in good shape. Out of Georgie Baker for Liv Alula. I must admit, a little bit surprised. I guess, can Roseman, who finished? Yeah, Roseman Gannon probably just never winning on, staying close enough on Wollunga anyway. So maybe it doesn't matter who, that they had to go for Baker. But yeah, Bertie Solo third. Stage two. This was a stage where a lot of different riders could win, finishing in Stirling. Yep. These are really grippy. These are horrible roads, like a lot of these roads around here, where like they look like 4 or 5%, or they say that, but they're so slow, some of these roads. And the sort of laps around Stirling in particular, I've done that laps around there. It's maybe because I was riding it, it was particularly slow, but yeah. Utrup Ludwig wins that stage, and this is the perfect sort of finish for her. She has a really, really good uphill kick, and which we saw when she won the Tour de France Femme stage 2 years ago, and she was like, no one really, people were in the picture, but they were five bike lengths behind her.
Where are the days where we were saying that Utrup Ludwig didn't have the punch back in the day? Like that switched across a span of 2.5 years where she now is one of those riders that is the go-to for a stage like this. So really good progress on that end. And it's also this two stage we mentioned so far, we're won relatively dominantly. Like other riders didn't exactly get close to winning. It was Utrup Ludwig clearly winning, Wollaston clearly winning. And would that be the same for stage three, which is, well, the obvious, Woolunga Hill. One difference is that it's only one rep of Woolunga Hill in the women's race. It's about a 94 kilometer stage, from my memory serves me right. Yes. And there were some echelons or something before we started, and Gigante was in trouble at a certain point. I think with 30k to go, there was an echelon where she was somewhat caught out, and she was able to save herself last minute from that problem. But anyway, that's an important factor. Otherwise, she might have actually fucked it for herself.
And that's important for the future to realize, like, she's a pure climber. Although she does have a good TT, but maybe, like, crosswinds is, or sort of messy race situations is where you could put her under pressure, I dare say. Probably doesn't have the volume of racing in Europe compared to some of the more experienced pros. She certainly has the watts, though. But I think I want to point out one from... I just saw one rider from race from stage two. Okay. It just popped up randomly. It's not the biggest thing, but she finished in the top 20, and it was an uphill finish. It's Yanina Kuskova, an Uzbek rider who's 22, who was riding for the Tashkent City team in this race, and she finished top 20. I didn't know that team was here, but that was actually a really, really good result for
mate, the Tour de France.
Really?
Yeah, because that was the Uzbek team that first of all had the kind of Uzbek championships that was a bit questioned. Then they won all those other races that gave them a lot of UCI points that were kind of like Uzbek centered or Asian games. I don't remember. There was something like that. They won so many points in like the Astana kind of races that they now have enough to go to the Tour de France Femme, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll see her win on Tourmalet or whatever there.
Hey, your favorite rider, Zablinska, is there.
Is she? She's still going. Still top 10 world TT worlds. Book it now. But yeah, that came. Willunga Hill, there was the big favorite. The QOM holder, who Sarah Gigante, who nuked this climb back in the Festival of Cycling in 2019. I think she nuked it, right?
No, 2021 was Festival of Cycling.
I swear she did a quick time in 2019 as well. But 2021, she destroyed everybody, but that was like during COVID. And she was the big favorite. And the question was when she was going to go. And it was pretty much at the base, even into a headwind. She went with Ludwig in the wheel. Ludwig was there for 500 meters. And basically the gap just started to slowly open. And Gigante, destroyed everybody into a headwind. Yep. She was just too good. Just moved to AG Insurance Sudal team from Movistar. I think they... with mutual agreement, broke the contract. She had, I think, another year this year on her contract with Movistar, but it clearly wasn't working there, or for whatever reason they wanted to move. And it appears to have been a good choice, because she wins on Willunga by 16 seconds ahead of Nienka Vinka, and takes out GC by 20 seconds. So
first
what a start.
Nienka Vinka, 19 years old, second on Willunga Hill, second in GC. That's insane. Like the whole top three as well. Neve Bradbury also still young. And I'm pretty sure there was what's her name? Fourth in the stage. No, fifth in the stage. Dominika Vlodarczyk?
Yeah.
Something like that. She's also really young as well. Amanda Spratt is the not 20-year-old of the top five, but so many youngsters in the top five of this Willunga Hill performance, which also shows that we've got some interesting years to come. But about Gigante? Is it Gigante or Gigante? I've been saying Gigante for years.
I don't actually know.
You're Australian. You should know. Is it kangaroo or kangaroo?
Kangaroo.
Okay. No shit, Sherlock. Anyway. onto a different topic. Gigante.
Yeah, that's an Aboriginal word. Kangaroo.
I'll call her Sarah for the sake of this argument. Sarah, she's had loads of trouble in the last few years, as in numerous issues along the likes of myopericarditis, which pericarditis is the thing that the Klerk had, which was the inflammation of one part of the heart, but she had inflammation on two parts of the heart. With like she came back from that now, and I think she's had some other injuries or struggles throughout the last years as well, last 2 years, and to see her coming back from that with this performance, yes. It's a 9:02 time, which is 50 seconds lower than the 2021 time. That's due to heavy headwind. But then she shows up after the women's Tour Down Under on that, it was pretty hyped up, as in this event after the women's standard and under, a time trial up Woolunga Hill, like a bit of a hill climb competition, like they have in the UK. 7:53 she did on that one. So she's a new QOM again, breaking her old time. So obviously it's a TT, so it's a different environment, less kilojoules in beforehand, perfect preparation probably in advance of that climb, but man, it's like, I'm happy she's back.
Yeah, it's good to see one of the big talents from, like when she broke onto the scene, and we're like, this is like the new climbing talent. And then she went to Movistar. I thought she's going to be the replacement. They probably thought she's going to be the replacement for Annemiek van Vleuten, is going to be their Tour de France leader. But certainly they brought a good team to this race, AG Insurance Soudal team, like Van der Velde, Gigante, Wollaston, Anya Lowe. They were really, really good. And I can't wait to see her in Europe fighting for GC in the big stage races. I think it certainly makes it much more interesting if we have Riolini, Gigante, others trying to actually fight Vollering, because Vollering is pretty good.
That's the conclusion of today. Yep. Vollering's pretty good.
Anything else from this women's race, Benji? I guess Ludwig, that's kind of just doing what she's been doing really, really well for a while.
But
I guess I want to see these riders at UAE Tour. Like, I want to see Ninka Vinka now on her feet in just under a month.
Yeah, but I also want to mention, I also felt like Triple Ludwig was doing her usual Sicily things on Woolunga Hill as well, where she tried to follow Gigante's attack to the point that she blew up and didn't finish second. Like, the same thing we've mentioned a few times when it comes to her. She has adapted a better strategy a few times now since we mentioned it last time in the Tour of Scandinavia, I think, a few years ago. But it's something she did again on Woolunga Hill, so I was like, oh, maybe that's something that she needs to once again.
Oh, wow. She finished 14th on that stage. She lost 1:02, so she must have lost. She must have completely blown up, because she would have been... The other riders that finished, say, on 47 seconds, like, she was way ahead of them in the first half of that climb. So, yeah, she went. But I guess you got to. She was thinking about winning GC. And if you don't hold Gigante's will, you lose GC. Other pure climbers to note is Marion Brunel. She didn't finish. She only finished 12th on Woolunga during the main race, but yeah, during that TT, I think she came second, closer to Gigante. Oh. So maybe struggles in the bunch a little bit. Obviously, like a pure climber, she's 19 on Saint-Michel Mavic Aubert. 93. Is that right? Is that really how they have to say it? Not only is it such a long name, but then the French for 93 is 4:20:13.
Wait. That, so they say
Saint-Michel Mavic Aubert 4:20:13.
You prefer the Wallonian version, which is non en trois?
What's that? Not like 93.
93 in Wallonian?
So wait, hold on. Breaking news. Wallonian French has a real word from the numbers from 80 to 100. You guys decided, nah, this is stupid. Well, not you guys, you obviously enemies, but really?
Oh, yeah, they do. And I was not allowed to say it that way. That's the thing. I had 8 years of French or something in school, and they taught me that I needed to do the correct French way and not the Wallonian one. So is that anti-Wallonian behavior in Flemish schools? I don't know about that.
I didn't know that. That's really interesting. So if you say that, I didn't know that. But yeah, that's a mouthful, that team name, when you factor in the extra words for 93. But yeah, just watch out for her if she gets into if there's like a Uni Puerto stage somewhere in the year without the big guns, she could go pretty well. Other news, or any other news around cycling, Benji? I guess one thing I had was, what is going on with, there's some pretty bad lids going around, some bad haircuts.
Oh,
people obviously
bored
in the off-season. Remco unveiled one where he basically looked like he said to the barber, fam, just cut in 2 inches into my part.
so there was that one. And then Pogacar's unveiled. I don't know who told him to do that. I mean, someone say like, these guys have all the money in the world and they can't get a good haircut.
What happened to Pogacar?
I think he dyed his hair blonde, no? Like blonde.
Oh my God,
like
he did.
It looks like Ellen DeGeneres.
Jesus Christ, what a comparison.
So guys need racing back is what I'm learning is guys, they've been training too much. They've just been doing back-to-back 30 hours a week in Spain. They get these guys back racing because they're going to the wrong barbers and they're getting bored. So yeah, Luke will flash those haircuts.
Vanderpool mullet? That's okay, right?
Vanderpool's mullet, yeah, that one, to me, that's play on. That's like a business mullet. You could go to work in Australia with that in a corporate job. No problem.
That brings me to my story time. I was in Denia a week ago for a week. I stayed at a hotel there and I thought, okay, I'm just going to go here, going to make a bit of content on the bike. Enjoyable. Turns out I was in the hotel with Canyon Schramm, the entire team, with Mathieu van der Poel at breakfast and in the elevators, with Jasper Philipsen at breakfast, with Javier Romo, Quinten Hermans. I was like, I felt like such an imposter. Like, I'm the guy doing 2 watts per kilo up a climb and dying, and these guys are doing 17 watts per kilo and celebrating. I felt so out of place, man. I felt so out of place.
Well, at least you're training and having fun. I mean, I've been going pretty well. I mean, we're trying to organize. We're going to Flanders to film some content in March. I hate the way I said it. Go to film some content. We're going to try and make a couple of videos together in Flanders in middle of March. And so what climb should we race up? We should let listeners, what climbs in Flanders should we race up? Or do you want to see our best efforts on? Is it the Quarmont? Should we try to see how far away from Poggi on the Quarmont are we? Or should it be the Paterberg? Which one should we do?
I'm down to race out of Quarmont. I'll try to survive the Paterberg. That's a difference between those two.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the
I can
Paterberg's
try
a
race
so
out of
Quarmont,
but... And also out of Quarmont, it's interesting because on the steeper early part, you'll get an advantage, but on the flat cobble par second part, I might be able to grind some wads, but you might have had who knows how close it is.
Yeah. So that's what we're gonna do and we're training for. So maybe Luke, you're gonna have Luke's time as well. That's all from us. Otherwise there's the sort of Valencia points farming races at the moment. There's like a one day race every day in the same region. The first sort of proper stage race coming after the TDU is the Valenciana.pro. That's on the 31st of January that starts. But otherwise, there's just like all these MISC, Mallorca or Valencia races in the next week. There's also in a week starting. Sorry, not in a week starting. Oh, yeah, there's GP Marseillaise, which is the first French 1-1, which is a couple of days before Étoile de Bessèges. Which is usually a decent race too, has crosswinds, mountain top finish, TT on the 31st as well. So season in Europe is already here. Don't know where the off season went. And thanks for listening as always. And I think our next pod will be the preview of Movistar, Canyon and Trek. So thanks for listening as always. We'll see you probably midweek. Till then, ciao.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.